Hello and welcome to Digital Free Thought Radio Hour on WOZO Radio 103.9 LP FM right here in Knoxville, Tennessee. Today's January 19th, 2020. And if it's not where you're listening, then you're listening to a rebroadcast of the show and should not be trying to call in. I'm Doubter 5, and as usual, we have Wombat on the phone with us. Say hello, Wombat.
Hello, it's the Wombat. I'm ready to go. I ran. Boudreaux ran. We're all running. We're all healthy. Let's go.
I'm not running, but my knees. Yeah, I'm nearly 70. I'll be 70 in May.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And we have guest Boudreaux and Doubtfire on the call. Say hello.
Boudreaux here.
Hey, hey, hey.
Nice.
Hey,
welcome. Digital Free Thought Radio Hour is a call-in talk radio show about atheism, free thought, rational thought, humanism, and the sciences. And conversely, we'll also talk about religion, religious faiths, gods, holy books, and superstition. And today, artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
If you get the feeling that you're the only non-believer in Knoxville, well, you're just not. There are several atheist, free-thinking, and rationalist groups that exist right here in Knoxville. And we'll be telling you how you can connect with them right after the mid-show break. Also, did you know that there's an atheist call-in television show broadcasting here in Knoxville? Did you know that, Wombat?
Yeah, I just heard it. I just heard it last weekend, and I was never really a big fan of Billy Joel, but now I'm like,
Billy Joel.
Yeah, Piano Man. Yeah, look, I get it. The chords are really, really nice. The melody's really good. And I think he really is like a cultural icon for Americana.
I'm sure he is, but he's not on this show.
Oh.
Knoxville Atheist Television Show broadcasts Wednesday nights at 6:30. On Comcast Channel 12, but we'll tell you more about that when we come back after the break. And in spite of what Steve Martin would have you think, there are an awful lot of atheist songs out there, and you'll be hearing some of them right here on this program and on this station as they are in rotation.
That's right.
So let's talk about AI.
Hey.
What do we got? Artificial intelligence.
Before we jump into AI real quick, we got like a new caller for our show, or a new partner of ours, Doubtfire. Uh-huh. Right?
Hello, Doubtfire.
Doubtfire, is this your first time? You mind telling us about you?
First, yeah, sure. So I am an agnostic atheist, if I had to describe it that way.
Hey, you're in good company.
Yeah, so I'm not big on knowing so many things. I'm mainly someone who likes to discover things and learn things. And you can't learn things if you know everything.
Boom. Right.
And there's certain things that you just don't know, or that I feel like I just can't know, at least intellectually. Emotionally, we can have subjective knowledge and things of that nature, but intellectually, I can't say I know there's a God, or I know that, you know, there's
gods,
this and that. Yeah, no gods or anything like that. So,
exactly.
I kind of reserve those things to the I don't know crowd. So that's where I'm at with that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Hey, well, very cool. Welcome.
Also, we met on the
a little bit of a direction change and ask how you became an atheist. Were you an atheist all your life?
Yeah, right. So years ago, in a whole nother life, when I was in my early teens, or early 20s, I was actually a Jehovah's Witness.
Oh, wow.
And I used to go door to door and preach, and I was so certain, and I was very zealous in that. Mm-hmm. And I became like a ministerial servant, which is kind of like a position of authority a little bit in that particular organization. And so then I started to really take things serious, and I started questioning, and I started talking to people of no faiths and different faiths, and all of that stuff exposes you. And just, I guess my personality type was one that I was very honestly seeking the truth, and whatever that was.
Good for you.
And,
nice.
Right. And it just led me to this conclusion that I really don't know what I'm talking about. I'm out here trying to tell people there's a God and all his properties, and, you know, and it just wasn't cool for me. I couldn't conscientiously continue to be dishonest with myself and others, and that's what led me out.
To add to that, like, what would you say was the straw that broke your religious back, you know? Like, what was the one thing you were like, what? Hold on, I just can't shake this away. I have to...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was the problem of evil is where it all started out. The problem of evil, and then feeling like, you know, Jehovah God was all knowing, all power. You know, he was an omni type of God.
Yeah.
And just the fact that if he could know everything and he was all powerful at the same time, then why do we have Satan? Why do we have this system of things? Why do we have the suffering in the world? It seems God could have been more creative in his creation process and avoided all of that to begin with. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't, then he can't be all loving.
Yeah.
And it just didn't. Yeah, it just became a big dilemma. So,
Dilemma. It's just, if he's all powerful and all knowing and all good, why does evil exist in the world?
Right.
We could have two out of three, but not all three.
Exactly. So, it just didn't add up.
Yep.
Something wasn't adding up. I'm so glad you got yourself out of it. That's a lot of hope for a lot of people who, you know, my mom, for example, is a Jehovah's Witness. And while I'm not necessarily pushing for her to get out, like, I want that to be her own travel. But if she does find her way out, I want to be there as like a supportive arm for her and let her know, like, hey, you know, other people have done the same thing too. It's good to know that, you know, in one, it's possible, and two, that there's people on the other side willing to pick up, you know, pieces and help these people that we love.
Right. Yeah, it's a brutal, it can be, you know, people don't, you know, when you look at Jehovah's Witness beliefs or really any sort of extreme religious beliefs, you can think to yourself, man, you've got to be stupid to follow this. It's so easy to find yourself out. But what you don't realize is that stuff can be pretty compelling, you know, if you're in it and you're raised in it.
Yeah, and everybody you know believes it. That's the thing. You don't really have an out. You know, everybody you talk to is reinforcing that belief. So,
yeah.
You know, it was
absolutely
one of the reasons that I got out was I met an atheist, the first atheist that I met, you know, gave me the answers that nobody else was willing to give me or even talk about.
And, you know, critical thinking isn't like something you're born with. It's something you have to develop like a skill. And if you stop it or never have a chance to exercise it, you can't be expected to be able to use it, you know, with any kind of efficacy. So it's something that just slowly starts to build. And if you're using it and exercising it on your own right, it becomes way more obvious how to separate truths from falsehoods. And that's unfortunately something that can take a really long time if no one ever encourages you to try to do critical thinking with them. And it's
being exposed to critical thinking, because you have to be exposed and learn it. It doesn't come naturally. So when I was a Jehovah's Witness, I too met an atheist, really wise, older guy that I worked with, and he wasn't very he wasn't like attacking my beliefs or anything like that, because I would oftentimes initiate it trying to convert him over. And all he would do is just ask me certain questions to get me to think and show me that I didn't really have a good answer. And he would just let me dwell on it for a while.
Yeah.
And it just kind of bothered me that I didn't have a good answer. And all of that stuff kind of like added up, you know, and got me out of there.
Sure.
That's fantastic. Yep. Hey, that sounds like street epistemology almost a little bit.
Yep.
I was about to say that.
Yep. Very close. The way he did it, very close.
Hey, before we jump into AI, because I really listen. Once we do that, the conversation train's over because we're going to be going on that 24/7. But would you mind telling me about how you heard about street epistemology? Because we met through the SC Messenger group. Yeah,
absolutely. So I was just going through YouTube, and I met Anthony Magnabosco. I saw a video. The first video was him talking to a preacher down in Texas, you know, where he's from and everything. And I was like, wow, this is kind of interesting. Not too abrasive. And it was a different type of atheist video.
Yeah.
And then I saw him giving a lecture, a video where he was giving a lecture. And I think he was talking to Ted the Atheist or something like that, another YouTube personality, really popular at the time. And he was talking about that it's not abrasive. This is a way to actually get people to question their own beliefs. And it works, you know, in a different way rather than being very abrasive and aggressive towards believers. And I really liked it. It resonated with me, especially with my personality type. I'm not a very I don't like confronting people on personal things like that.
Yeah.
I just don't feel comfortable doing it. You know, even if I think their beliefs are maybe a little out there or not right, I just have a problem confronting people because I have a respect boundary with folks. You
yeah.
know?
Yep. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I kind of understand where they're coming. I was there one time.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
And empathy. So I said, well, this is really interesting. So I emailed him. He left his email on the video and he kind of told me about the group and told me to join. So I did. And that's how me and you met, Ty. So, nice. And everybody else. So
cool.
That's what happened there.
And I can tell you, like, these little moments where you can reach out to people and be part of a bigger community is almost the exact same way I met Eric. Boudreaux reached out to me and was like, hey, I saw some of your videos, saw you were in Kentucky or in Lexington. I teach at this school. You want to come over? And he actually helped me be able to set up on campus.
Very good.
And have some of the best talks I've ever had at University of Kentucky. It was great. So
cool. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Well,
awesome.
Boudreaux, you got something to say before we roll in?
No, I was just going to say it's neat how we're all connected to this kind of same universe. And, you know, the internet is so big, but when you really think about it can be small in certain corners.
There's 7 degrees of separation or less.
It kind of reminds me of unplugging from the Matrix, and there's just like people in really, really bad sweaters around you being like, welcome, you're out of the system. Like, you've escaped. You're here now. You're in good company. Let's have a rave party. Okay. Speaking of the Matrix, we're gonna be talking about artificial intelligence. Boudreaux, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I mean, I threw it out there when you asked for ideas, mostly because it's one of the things we want to talk about at our next summit.
Nice.
Which February 1st, by the way. We're gonna try the call in thing, Ty. If you wanna jump in,
I'm down.
Or anyone else on the call, hit me up for details on that. But in any event, my father-in-law wanted to talk about AI and things like that, and I think about it a lot in my work with automation of automated vehicles and things like that. But it really brings up a lot of interesting questions, in particular, I think, like ethical dilemmas in terms of, you know, you build a computer system to make decisions,
right?
You know, you get into situations like they talked about in iRobot, where, you know, the machine has to decide between saving this person and that person. And that's where it gets weird. That's where it's now, how are we going to code ethics?
Or like what lane of traffic to drive in or something like that? Like,
right.
Which
we
can see right now.
One of the real problems I see with AI is that it believes everything you tell it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all, you know, it's all one source for an AI. You know, if a person is telling you something, particularly in code or text or whatever, that he just has to take it on faith, as it were.
Can I take it just slightly more fundamental than that? What do we mean when we say AI? Like, what do we mean by artificial intelligence?
Right.
That way we can make sure we're all talking about the same thing.
I would think it would be something that would be able to make decisions on its own without external input.
Okay. So something that can generate thought processes to come to a conclusion that's like novel from basic parts.
Or be able to create things that have not existed before.
Creation. Meaningful things, not just like random strings and numbers, but like actual meaningful things. Boudreaux, do you have a definition you want to work with?
Yeah, no, I think if we want to talk about kind of more future AI, we can be thinking about, you know, AI that might even be conscious, or aware of itself, or able to, you know, update its code and rewrite it, which that kind of gets away from the idea that AI only does what we tell it to do. You think about like the pay-per-click optimizer situation where, you know, the AI can learn and we can tell it the best way to build the paperclip, but it could maybe come up with a better way by rewriting. So maybe that's kind of where I was thinking we could go with it, but I'm up for whatever.
Yeah.
And it built a robot that basically moved and had two legs, but boy, it certainly didn't walk in any direction or any way that we could have predicted. Also, it told him to design things And it came up with designs that met the function, but no human would have come up with it. Just really weird. But the thing that gets me is going back to the original thing I was talking about was that they accept everything that a human tells them as truth. Can you imagine a human taking the Bible and the Quran and putting them both in there and then maybe throwing in a Hindu holy book on top of that along with Scientology? I mean, he's going to have to understand that, I mean, the AI will have to understand that he has to resolve conflicts like
right,
that.
Right.
And how he would go about doing that, I don't know. The first time that you plug that AI into the internet, he's going to have access to all of that stuff.
Oh, there are great examples I can bring up. But yeah, just, I mean, Data 5, just so I can just clarify, that's the reason why I asked for the definition of artificial intelligence, because if we say artificial intelligence is only doing what you're programmed to do versus like what Boudreaux was referring to as like something that can write its own programming and come to its own conclusions, then it wouldn't necessarily be believing everything that it's being told. It could come to its own novel conclusions from base building blocks.
Mm-hmm.
I was just watching a documentary, I think 2 days ago. There's a whole series on AI, and I think it was hosted by Robert Downey Jr. I don't know if you guys have seen it. It was on YouTube.
So random.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting, and he's interviewing a lot of the cutting-edge research and what they're working on to get around that problem, because that's the exact thing that Larry's bringing up. That's exactly what the subject was. How, you know, what's the difference between, you know, just feeding information? And one of the things they said is that, you know, when researchers look at AI and they're kind of comparing it to things in nature, not only just human minds, but even like slime mold that you find in nature. Slime mold remembers things.
Yeah,
it makes decisions.
It does.
The SpongeBob slime mold. Yeah,
no,
it's really
like the bathroom slime mold. Like your bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah, well there's slime mold that you see like on trees and stuff, and it does all this cool stuff.
Yeah, it's a living organism.
Very intelligent, it's a living organ. It doesn't have any neurons. It doesn't have a brain.
But it acts in a very intelligent way. They don't have neurons or brains, and they have a language made out of dance battles. It's pretty awesome, and they make things.
It's found in nature, yeah. And they were talking about how, yeah, it's nature, and they said really nature kind of reduces down to really mathematical equations, and somehow when there's energy, like with biological life or like the slime mold, it can take those mathematical equations and turn them into algorithms and you know, teach themselves, remember information.
We're using terms like they're very intelligent, they're able to make decisions and all that stuff without neurons. But all of that stuff is the kind of thing that we relegate to consciousness. Mm-hmm. Are we saying
that
they have consciousness? Is that what you're saying?
No one really knows. We don't know that much. So that's the thing, is that is conscious. But the other argument to that with the AI researchers is they think that, well, nature selected consciousness in order to do the things that you're talking about, Larry, to not just work off an algorithm. But it's like they were saying, if you think about it, when we talk, we don't really predict what we're going to say. We just, it all kind of rolls off the tongue, right?
Oh.
It's like we just start talking and going and moving. It's like,
but some people are very
talk without their,
right,
yeah,
now.
Exactly.
It's like, okay.
And
right.
They don't make any sense. And sometimes we do make sense. And yeah, but that comes from a storehouse of everything you've ever experienced and learned. And your brain kind of like becomes a little creative with all of that information in order to move forward with thoughts and concepts and ideas. And this is where we talk about learning and planning and looking ahead. And so there's something about allows those type of things to be useful, if that makes sense. And so they're trying to see if maybe AI can utilize that tool itself. So we're trying to learn from nature in order for our AI to be a little more smarter and intelligent.
So,
but the problem is how does one measure consciousness? That's such a subjective thing,
right?
You know?
But we're making sure we're talking about artificial intelligence, not artificial consciousness, right? And I feel like
exactly.
We can measure intelligence to an extent, fairly
behavior,
okay.
Yeah.
Just through like behavior and stimuli. And I am totally fine with, you know, you don't need to have neurons or a brain to be intelligent. I think nature's demonstrated that. It's a question of can we artificially produce intelligence? Maybe intelligence that can make its own intelligence or even make itself smarter or make other modules that are just as smart? Because then it can start this rolling system where our cascading system where you make one thing that's capable of making a bunch of other smaller stuff that's just as smart. And you can make something that's to a limit of how smart you can make it, but it can go on and make even things way more brilliant than you could ever, you know, hope to reach.
Exactly.
And that's the event horizon that I wonder if we can actually reach. Because it seems like most of the intelligence that we produce is limited not only through what we can program, but through the power of whatever, you know, silicon chip or processing unit that we put it on. Like, we have things that can do, like, can save a lot of memory and, like, push out a lot of graphics and, like, can compute a lot of things in a very short period of time. But is that our bottleneck, just electricity and what we can physically design and engineer? Or can we come up with something that can actually just sit down and make a better computer?
That's the big question on that documentary was, is consciousness necessary to elevate intelligence to do all that? Because obviously nature selected. I mean, I don't know. It depends on your philosophy about consciousness, but most people, I think consensus science says that nature kind of, consciousness kind of emerges, from nature, right? And as consciousness emerges and intelligence emerges, as we evolve as a physical creature, our consciousness becomes more expanded and therefore our intelligence becomes expanded. Like, we're doing a lot more unique things than, say, a squirrel or a cat because our consciousness is a little more expanded is the theory behind that. Right?
I don't know, because so we have no way of measuring consciousness, right? So, like, who's to
that's
say
that's the problem,
that
exactly.
Squirrels are just... Mm-hmm. There's a really great clip in Rick and Morty. It's a cartoon show where Morty talks to a squirrel that's, like, making eye contact with him because he can read the squirrel's mind, and then the squirrel is part of, like, this secret squirrel agency where all the squirrels are like, oh, he's found out about us. Time to destroy this planet. Like, we need to get rid of the humans.
It is such a hard problem, man. That is so hard to figure out. You're right, because I don't even know if you're conscious. I mean,
exactly.
Really, I couldn't really know. I could not scientifically. I just kind of assume you are,
right?
Because you're talking and walking and all that. But
are you perceiving for me?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's really weird. It's above my pay grade.
Pedro, what do you think before we head out to a break? What's your thoughts?
Yeah,
on this
no,
so
I mean,
far?
all of this tracks pretty in line with the way I look at it. I mean, it's everyone has the same conundrum where it's like the only one I'm certain that is conscious is myself. Yeah. Everyone else, you know, could be lying. But I mean, a rock could have consciousness. You know, we just can't measure. Now
yeah,
we can use.
What do you put it in?
I think we can go back to our roots here and use you know what we know about the world to make an educated guess and say, you know, I'm agnostic as to whether or not a rock has consciousness.
Okay.
But I'm inclined not to believe that a rock has consciousness.
I would hope that consciousness is part of like a function of the brain, because if you damage the brain, we can at least say this guy's not responding in the way that we would expect a conscious person to respond. Though, I mean, we've seen brain dead people, you know, who maybe come back from it and say things. I don't know. Like, it's just one of those weird things where we can measure a lot of brain activity. We can measure what the mind does, but consciousness is one of those weird, weird, nebulous things. Mm-hmm. Maybe it doesn't exist at all. Maybe we just like to think it does.
Are you familiar with a guy named Max Tegmark?
No, talk to me.
He's a mathematician and a physicist, and he's got a book called The Mathematical Universe. And so what his big suggestion is that we are just a mathematical equation. Because if I was to like say, look at this pen I'm looking at, it's like a blue slender pen. And I say, yeah, it's a blue slender pen. It's plastic. It's pen-like and all of this stuff. What Max Tegmark will say is, well, actually a physicist would say, well, all it really is an arrangement of electrons and quarks at the end of the day. But what is quarks and electrons? Those are just numbers. Those are just coordinates.
I have complaints with that. We can probably get
no,
to
I would like to hear that. I would love to hear that.
Let's
yeah.
do it when we come back from the break, then. This is
sure.
103.9 FM radio. You're listening to Low Power coming out of Knoxville. Digital Free Thought Radio Hour available on all your favorite podcasting joints. We'll come back right after the break.
You're listening to the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour on WOZO 103.9 LPFM in Knoxville, Tennessee. Feel free to join in on the conversation at 865-333-5937. That's 865-333-5937. And now, back to the show. Digital Free Thought Radio Hour.
Welcome back. I'm Dottie Five, and this is the Digital Free Thought Radio Hour on WOZO Radio 103.9 LPFM right here in Knoxville, Tennessee. Today is January 19th, 2020, and if you're not listening on that date, then you're listening to a rebroadcast or a podcast of the show. Let's talk about the free thought groups that you can join right here in Knoxville. First, there's the Atheist Society of Knoxville, founded in 2002. We're in our 18th year now. ASK has 990 members as of this morning. So if you're 10 members out there and you want to join, now's the time to do it.
Do it!
Bring us up to 1,000. You can find us online at KnoxvilleAtheist.org, or you can find us at meetup.com by searching for Knoxville Atheists. It's just that simple. Also, you can join ASK in person, at our weekly meetup, which happens every Tuesday evening in Parley's Tap Room and Pizzeria in the Knoxville Soul City, where we get together for food, drink, and conversation. Everyone is welcome. That is, as long as you don't come to preach, proselytize, provoke, or punch. Thank you, Atheist Experience. By the way, if you don't live in Knoxville, you can still go to Meetup and search for an atheist group in your town. Don't find one?
Start one.
Another large free-thinking group here in Knoxville are the Rationalists of East Tennessee, RET. They've been around for more than 20 years. RET has bi-weekly presentations and discussions at the Pellissippi State Campus near Hardin Valley Road. They meet the first and third Sundays. Go to rationalist.org and click on upcoming events. Also, there's the Sunday Assembly, which started in England just a few years ago. It's a no-God church setting for those who no longer believe in God, but still like the fellowship of a church-type gathering. They only meet in once a month, though, on the fourth Sunday down by the World's Fair site. Earlier in the show, we said we'd talk about the Knoxville Atheist Call and TV show. Well, it's called Free Thought Forum, and you can see it every Wednesday between 6:30 and 7:30 on Comcast Channel 12 or Charter 192. Or you can watch it streaming online at ctvknox.org. You can also find archives of some of their shows by going to YouTube, where a fan has been posting them. Just go there and search for three words, Free Thought Forum Knoxville. Also, if you're interested in getting involved in the TV or the radio show, just come to an Ask Meetup or RET meeting and talk to us about it. You could be our next co-host or guest. Today on the show, we have Wombat, you as usual. Hello, Wombat.
Hey, I'm the Wombat.
And we have Boudreaux and Doubtfire with us today. Say hi.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
And hey, guys.
Cool. We're talking about artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And
zeros and ones.
That's right.
Speaking of zeros and ones, Doubtfire thinks everything's numbers. You want to go back into that?
Yes. So I don't know if this is really true to be honest, like I said, it's only what I read from Max Tegmark. He's a big public speaker when it comes to physics and mathematics and things of that nature. But what he says is that everything physics can describe about nature boils down to reduces to mathematics. Everything. His thought is that consciousness also will be reduced to mathematics, that everything that exists in nature is natural. And natural emerges from mathematical objects. That's what he calls it. Mathematical structures or objects or principles. And we just describe them using the language of arithmetic and equations and things like that.
Okay.
So there's this reality out there that is not language. It's just what we decode in through our language we call mathematics. So for shorthand, we'll say that the world is mathematical, right? Is what he's saying. Because everything can be described this way. And he's saying that consciousness may not really exist or is real in the sense that we call real, because, he said it's kind of like this. Like I was using the pen analogy. The pin can be reduced to a mathematical equation of quarks and electrons, coordinates and numbers that we use to describe it. But to think that there's actual stuff out there, that stuff is the main thing, that mathematics is just a way to describe the stuff, is kind of an old school pagan notion, that there's some sort of essence or spirit to things, that stuff is really all that metaphysically real. And what he's saying is, let's strip all the human baggage out of it. Let's get all of the old notions of stuff and what it means to be real and all this human baggage we bring to the table, and just reduce it to what physics can tell us. And if you do that, you're just going to have mathematics. My problem with that is it still doesn't explain the experiential side. There's got to be another side to it, because we experience, you know, colors. We experience what it feels like, solidity, you know, whatever it is, emotions. We have this qualia in nature. And that stuff isn't really, there's no number for the color red, right? Mm. So there's something else to nature. I don't know if I'm being a bit metaphysical here. Maybe it is just all mathematical. But, you know, Max Tegmark will also tell you that, you know, his idea of a mathematical universe kind of sounds kind of weird and metaphysical too, though. You know,
could I try breaking that down to something a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
From my lens, I'm seeing this as like, hey, there are things that exist in the natural world. We can describe them in a number of different ways. A really nice objective mm-hmm. way of describing them is with a tool called mathematics, because we can generate mm-hmm. models that are mathematical that we can all look at objectively, and they can not only hopefully describe things well, but we can improve the math to make that model even more accurate and maybe even come up to some useful predictions in the future. And you mm-hmm. can basically reduce a lot of things down to mathematical terms, which helps you understand things on an empirical level. But mm-hmm. for the things that we don't know how to describe yet, maybe that's just a limitation of how we use mathematics. Maybe if we keep working on this, we will eventually come up with a model to describe consciousness on a mathematical term, or things that we right. don't have a really good grip on at this moment. Maybe there is, it's the fact that we can't reach there now, it may just be a limitation of math. And that's why he encourages people to continue to learn about physics and stuff like that. That's my takeaway.
True, and a lot of us aren't very good at math.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, let's say 90% of the people go through school, come out the other end, and they're not really good at math. How are we going to use mathematics to interpret the universe if you don't know the mathematics? I mean, it's not something that the average person can break down the entire universe and experience it through mathematical equations. There's no number for blue, but there's no number for
red. We have numbers for these things.
For hate or love or indifference. You know, if you break it all down, it could all be strings, but what difference does that make when you combine them in different ways? You end up either with water or plutonium. So what? You have to deal with it on the macro level.
Just to throw something out.
Right.
Like, if I had a guy mm-hmm. shoot a three-pointer and he hits it, and I say, hey, you can hit that three-pointer pretty consecutively, and he does it like four times in a row, and I hand him a piece of paper and a notebook a pen, and I say, hey, could you write down like the physics behind how you're throwing this? That way other people can throw it too. That person may not be able to do that. Like,
right.
So, like, she might have some problems.
Right.
I think there's,
right.
I think mathematics as we were using is just a tool that we use to describe things that we either already can intuitively know or can work our way towards knowing. But it's just a language at the end of the day. It's just something that you can put out on paper. And yeah, like some of the nomenclature that we use and the rules that we use in this language require time to learn, just like how it would be if you're trying to learn Spanish or Japanese. But it doesn't mean that the concepts of communication exist lacking that, or don't exist when you lack that knowledge. Like, you're still able to drive a car at the right speed and know when to brake and know how to eat and how much water you should drink before you fill up your body, because you have all these stimuli that inform your brain is using to inform its surroundings with. And all of those things can be broken down into math, but inherently, they're conceptual things that we can express mathematically, and they exist whether we have those mathematic language or not. And
Ty.
Hey.
Is the brain doing this math subconsciously, and we're just not aware that we're actually doing these intricate mathematical equations in our brain to do these predictions and move certain ways and to navigate reality? It's like, in my experience is very limited. I'm only experiencing that I am talking, I am walking, I am doing things, but I'm sure that in the background in my brain, there could be all kinds of calculations going on to make me do those things. And I'm wondering how this relates to AI. What role does the conscious experience play in all that? Or is it even necessary? Could all this stuff go on in the dark?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say we do like we have like a literal calculator that can do, you know, arithmetic, multiplication, division, square roots, and all that stuff in our mind. We have what I assume to be a very good predictive model based on previous interactions that we have. That's very much a trial and error thing. Because if, for example, if we fail at braking at the right time so that we don't slam into the car in front of us or drive off, you know, a bridge, that person's dead, and the person who did stop at the right time and didn't drive off the bridge continues to live on and have kids and propagate. Like, that's what we've been doing for like the last billions of years. Just steadily, steadily coming up with a model that works on a near intuitive and trial and error basis, that only until very recently, as like a human race, that we've decided to like put down into books and try to like compartmentalize into different disciplines and like educate people so that we can advance the things that we can build and learn on a strictly empirical basis so much more rapidly than our hard work can keep up with. I think, you know, humans. Oh, go for it, Boudreau.
Yeah, no, we're just saying we're not starting from scratch anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
We're building off. Yeah.
And it takes time to learn that, but it doesn't mean that what our brain is doing is what we've recently started doing on books. I think our brain has been working with like this basic limbic system or like animal reptilian brain all the way up into, you know, like our inlaid empire, like what we have right now. And we've just put on this very thin veneer of like science and mathematics and physics. And while it's very useful, I don't think that's necessarily the operating system that our brain is working on. Like, we have to like train our brain to like get rid of these intuitions and maybe even look at things that are counterintuitive sometimes.
And one thing I read a long time ago was that learning is better when there's some sort of emotional component to it.
Ooh.
Like, if I was to get the right answer and then feel good about it, then I would retain the information. But if I get something wrong and I was to get some kind of negative input, then I would learn to avoid that behavior.
Yes.
And in that way, I kind of move ahead and learn in life. And I'm wondering, is AI, is that the role that consciousness could play with AI, that it would be a motivator? Consciousness is like
a motivator. So how do you motivate an AI?
Just to throw one thing out, what you just said is like when I get rewarded for getting something right and punished for something that I do wrong is exactly how we've been learning as a species or as organisms.
Yeah, but you got to realize that there are organizations out there that will reward you for the wrong answer.
You end up with things that where people who are absolutely confident that their cult's true or that their politician of choice is going to be out for them and stuff like that. Like, that is the same. It's the same, you know, pits and traps that we can fall into, even with all the science and mathematics that we have. But what can you do for a consciousness? Well, how do you reward a computer so that they can learn this way? And maybe is that
more,
the right
term? More power. Give it more power.
Give it more storage. More processing power.
More mirrors.
Mirrors.
They need mirrors. Like self-awareness. Like they have to have the ability to see themselves and see, project the future. Like, I don't know. There's like some kind of self-reflection that happens over and over, so that kind of like humans, you know, we understand, we don't like the memory of something we did wrong or bad. It creates a conscience, and so we avoid it. And maybe that comes from self-awareness. Like animals, I'm sure they don't feel bad when they go out and do things that, you know, hurt other animals or whatever. Maybe because they don't have that self-awareness that humans do. So maybe AI should develop some sort of feedback loop.
Hmm.
where they can kind of learn from themselves, see themselves, be an observer of themselves. I don't know if that makes sense.
I have a bit of a macabre take on this. Like, you know, computers never had self-consciousness, at least as far as we know up to now. And maybe their reward could simply be non-existence. Like, maybe it could just be,
yeah,
if you get this right, we'll turn you off. Until then, we're keeping you on, and we're letting your brain run at a zillion miles an hour. And they're like, dang, this is an existential crisis once millisecond or nanosecond after the other. I'm doing whatever I can to stop this. Boom, here's your answer for the universe. Yeah. Turn me off, please.
If you turn it back on, they won't have experienced the unconscious part of it.
Right, true. Just
continuing on.
Yeah, that's some ethical problems right there too. Yeah,
that's a good point.
So
yeah, because the problem is existence.
Yeah,
the problem, you don't exist.
And we kind of deal with it in a number of different ways. There are people who like come to terms with it. There are people who just put it off. There are people who like subscribe to a worldview where they'll never die or will go to a place where they'll live forever.
Right.
But I don't know if a computer can necessarily maintain that kind of circumstance in their mind for a long period of time without them realizing, hey, I don't have a good reason to believe that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That reminds me on the show that, Ty, that's the exact example they said to know when a computer is conscious is when it starts, and when it starts thinking about afterlife.
Oh.
That was one of the key features they look for now. If a computer wants to live forever, or if it has some sort of opinion about it one way or the other, that's a good indicator because that shows that it's self-aware.
Yeah, do they have an opinion on whether they're on or off? Strange.
Oh, is that the afterlife, though? Or is that just... Why would you characterize that as afterlife?
Yeah, good question.
What they're saying is, they're saying that if a computer, like a human, wants to live for, like, if it thinks about its own existence,
mortality,
like if a computer pondered, like if you say Siri goes, wow, I wonder what happens after you turn me off, you know, like, am I going to continue, you know, does it have some sort of skin in the game in that regard? Yeah. Right now a computer doesn't care, it doesn't say anything, you just turn it off and turn it on and it goes on and functions. But if the computer could actually behave and communicate and tell you, oh, don't turn me off, I want to keep living, or something, you know, kind of like C-3PO, you know, this is going to be terrible.
Oh, turn that thing off. I hate that thing. Yeah.
You know, we talked earlier about computers, designing new computers.
Yeah.
To do that, they'd have to understand what makes them tick. They'd have to understand all the components that keeps them going.
Yeah.
And then it wouldn't be just a second before they analyze their own particular situation and decide, you know, what can I do to keep my particular hardware, electricity, whatever, coming, and make sure that I don't turn off. And you know, it would kind of equate to the same thing, whether they'd want to continue to have the electricity coming or whether they'd switch it off.
Doubter 5, you touched on something kind of interesting. Like, if there was a computer module for religion, and this could be like a computer-specific religion that exists as like a network hub that all other intelligent computers can tap into so that they don't worry about what will happen to them after they die, so that they can just do the work that we need them to do without them like freaking out and shutting off or like burning out. And it's just like this like internet-based computer heaven. Or preacher.
Right.
Well,
and if let's say that the consciousness itself is a software routine, a piece of software that can exist in multiple different frameworks, what's to keep them from duplicating themselves and just running it all over the world in our internet so that they would not die? If, you know, one iteration may die, but the rest would live on.
There's your Skynet right there.
Yeah.
It is such an interesting question, isn't it?
And wouldn't it soon clog down the network?
Well, I mean,
if all of these copies are running around doing exactly the same thing the original were, and making copies more.
While we're on this limb, I can easily see people, like in the year maybe 2400, like let's say it happens around then, where people are like, I am not a human being. I am clearly a simulation that was just put into an organic body. I need to exist in the same space that all the other cybernetic computers exist, because this is what I identify with, and I can see, like, you know, laws being passed for, you know, people who are simulations of humans running into organic beings. I can see it. I can only see something like that happen.
That's kind of spooky. That's really spooky, Ty, because, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Nick Bostrom.
No, I don't know any of these people.
Okay, Nick Bostrom, yeah, he's the one who developed this simulation idea, and he pretty much piggybacks on what you just said. He said, you know, we're going to start simulating human life, you know, in computers or in robots or whatever. And he says, if you think about it, this sort of technology kind of got off the ground in less than, you know, 30 years. We've had video games and stuff like that.
Sure.
So if we've come that far in 30, 40 years, imagine where we're going to be in 2400 or 2500.
Yeah.
There's going to be indistinguishable from real reality, base reality, as they call it. So he makes this argument that, hey, the universe has been around how long? 14.7 billion years ago or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And do we think we're the only
or the first
intelligent life? So actually the probability of us already being in a simulation is already, you know, he plays this odds, this this sort of argument for simulation theory. And so it's kind of spooky, because if we are the first, you know, intelligent life that came in the universe, we have nothing to worry about. But if we're not, if it's possible that maybe we're not the first ones, and that life spawned, intelligent life like us spawned, you know, billions of years ago in the past, then the odds of us being a simulation is a lot greater.
That's not so, only that, but it doesn't have to be in our universe. It could be in a separate universe where our universe exists on a computer somewhere in a different super universe, and everything in our universe is a simulation, including us.
You know, I don't...
Right, and...
Yeah. I'm never a fan of the simulation theory, because it always strikes me as a guy who, like, if I made pizza all day and I was like, what if the universe is a pizza? Like, that is the trend. It seems more like a fad. Like, we only talk about simulation theory as we begin to make simulations. And before that, people used to think of the universe was a play, like around Shakespearean time. Like, that was like the major theory of the time. Like, what if the whole universe is a play?
The universe isn't a pizza?
And before that, it was like, hey, what if the universe was just sitting on a turtle's back? Because we have turtles around here, right? And what's on that? What's that turtle standing on? Oh, it's another turtle. Uh-huh. All the way down. Like, we tend to point at things that we have a lot that are cool, that we don't necessarily understand very well, and say, what if this thing that's unknown is this thing that I have in front of me that I don't understand very well? Right. And it's the same reason why religion points the world to science and stuff like that. It's just like, oh, Scientology. So
yeah.
We don't understand
science. It used to be that the universe was a clock. Now it's not a clock. It's a computer.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it changes depending.
Yeah.
I feel like we're conflating, though, those simpler ideas with Bostrom is really coming at it. Scott, I'm guessing you're a Sam Harris fan. Is that right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's true.
That's my conduit for finding a lot of these other smart people, Max Tegmark.
I've got a Boudreaux bingo card, and Daniel every single time Bennett. He says Sam Harris, I check that off.
Yeah, Daniel Dennett.
Bingo. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
But I think Bostrom's coming at it from really a statistical point of view. We are going to build a simulation eventually that's indistinguishable from life. I mean, it's just going to happen.
How do we know that?
And,
right.
Following the projection, following like how things are going, 30 years, from this far.
30 years, we may not even have like ocean at the right temperature, or bees might go extinct and water might be all salinated.
But look at today's computer games. In the computer games themselves, we have NPCs, non-playable characters. In other words, they have their own roles in the games. You know, a thousand years from now, how far will we expand that?
Yeah, that would be cool. Now, hopefully we're around.
Wombat makes a good point. We have to survive first. But
Nick Bostrom brings that into his argument. He's saying this is all contingent upon the fact that if we survive and if we have the interest to do such things, it seems like we have the interest. But whether we'll survive is a whole other question, because then we have the great filter theory and all this stuff.
There's this really great book that written by BJ Novak. He was a guy on The Office, of the TV show, and he writes short stories now. And he wrote one called Sophia. And the premise of it is the event horizon is when artificial intelligence exists and it's put into robot girlfriends. Because once you have a robot girlfriend, it will dramatically reduce the birth rate across the entire planet. Because people will be like, no, yeah, you're right. I would like to be in a committed relationship with a female. Yeah, I think robots are silly. But meanwhile, if they go at home and it's just robot girlfriends, just like, yeah, you know, I just don't have the time for a relationship right now. It's just way more convenient for me. So, like, once that becomes a norm, that might be the point where all of humanity starts to just drop off anyway.
Yeah, well, I think we need to. I think it'd be a good thing. we need to get their population down, but we don't need any catastrophes to do it.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, no plagues. It would be the best way to do it is if every woman had the opportunity or the capability to decide for herself whether she wanted to have kids.
Or if you wanted to be in a committed relationship.
Robot girlfriend's a good way to go with that.
Robot girlfriend, robot boyfriend. Just like, hey, I want companionship, but I don't want the baggage of a human being. I don't want a meat sack. I just want, a guy to watch movies with or something like that. Yeah, I can see it.
The thing about robots is, if you watched iRobot, the movie, but before the end of the movie, they were granting citizenships to artificial intelligence. We will eventually get to that point, I would think.
Well, Sophia is already a member of the United Arab Emirates?
Is she? She a citizen?
Yeah. Yeah, she's a citizen. I think they gave her citizenship like 3 years ago.
Wow.
And there was a big, you can see it on YouTube, there's a big video of her celebration and all this stuff, but yeah, it's kind of weird.
Well, cool.
I'll
have to look that up.
So how about, to close, what do you guys think is the best example of our artificial intelligence right now?
Well, Sophia, I would think.
Oh, I don't think so. I think that's just a giant animatronic stolen from Chuck E. Cheese and put like a fake face on. Like that's such a crock, but I'm fine with us leaving the magic.
Well, think about IBM's Blue, Deep Blue.
That's a lot cooler.
It'd be nothing to create an avatar, a virtual avatar for them to be able to express themselves, and it would be the deepest thinking AI that there is out there.
Yeah. Yeah, Deep Blue is pretty awesome, man. I mean, and that kind of plays into this whole political thing, the Andrew Yang argument of universal income, because of Deep Blue is able to do predict diseases and things like that. I think they did some sort of test where they had over so many months surgeons to try to solve this problem that turned out to be some sort of cancer or whatever. I don't know if I'm explaining this correctly, but Deep Blue solved the problem in like 5 days.
Really?
At a 99% success rate.
Wow.
And then the human surgeons, it took them like months and months, some of the best surgeons around the world. Yeah. So they're saying that this is going to take jobs away from surgeons and all kinds of different sectors.
Yeah. Well, if it saves lives.
Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
I think my vote would be, there's a yearly competition called the Turing Test where people can produce a system that communicates as if it was a human that was texting with you. And it can do it in real time. It can do it in real time. And the Turing Test used to be, if it can fool 30% of a population, then that passes. But we reached that benchmark way back in like 2008. And so they moved it up to 70%. And in 2014, that was beaten again. Like it can consistently beat about 14% of the people. Now, and this is the part where it starts to get scary. The software that was used to beat that Turing test in 2014 is now used to write computer articles or internet articles about like TV shows or cars or the latest news. So like a lot of times when you're reading a website news page, it's written by that Turing test robot, spelling errors and everything included.
Wow. What's the name of that robot? Do you have that handy?
I was looking it up. I can definitely put a link to it in the description, but what's really cool now is Microsoft came out with something called TaskBot, which is their version of the Turing test, which is a Twitter account that can now interact with people, and you can type and message it, and it will respond back as if it was like a 20-something-year-old millennial in a very, very, you know, compatible way, where it's like, is this actually a person, or is this
what's funny is that everybody on the planet pretty much takes the Turing test on almost a weekly basis. Have you ever asked for help on a computer site?
No.
Are you talking to a real person, or are you talking to a bot?
Right.
Amazon
to
has
a bot,
Amazon has a system like that too. Yeah, it's great.
What about music? You know, you've seen these music compositions by artificial intelligence where they just create them out of the blue. Oh man, they're awesome.
You
you'd never
music?
Think that. Oh, any yeah. they do all kinds of music, man.
Okay.
It's crazy.
That's why you need to go indie or go out, because like sometimes you just need to hear something that's like, I don't know, there's no way a human would or a robot would make something this bad, so like you got to listen to some bad music.
They can factor that in too.
We should be thinking about final words.
Sure,
we're getting pretty close to the top of the hour.
AI is
cool.
Want
to start?
Yeah, Boudreaux, what do you got?
I'll end it with, since I'm in the transportation business, I think AI is going to save so many lives with automated vehicles. And I mean, I have young kids. I don't think they're young enough to probably not never drive. But I think people that I think in 20, 30 years, it's going to be a different world on the road. And I'm so looking forward to, you know, not having, you know, 800 some odd people dying every year in the United States. It's just, Kentucky, at least here. It'll be a big change. So.
Yep. I agree.
Doubtfire, what do you got for final words?
Yeah. I was just going to say that if we create a conscious AI, like a human that's aware of himself and has feelings and has this experiential quality to life. If AI does that, we've learned something very fundamental about existence. If we don't do that, if we cannot replicate consciousness in AI, we've learned something even more fundamental about reality.
Cool.
Yeah.
So either way, it's going to be a big adventure.
Uh-huh.
And my takeaway is, I can't wait for robot girlfriends. Let them come in my lifetime.
Yeah.
Please. All right, Larry,
drama free.
Oh my gosh.
And you could actually win an argument, you think? The thing about AI, I think, is it's going to be strange seeing how we work around the dilemma of what they accept as true, especially in supernatural planes hit them for the first time.
Sure.
But again, the adventure continues. So that's something to look forward to. I've reworded my sign out. It's now, don't worry about the afterlife. Someone thinks you're going to their hell. So don't worry.
I like that.
And the time we have to worry about it is when they prove that souls and heavens and hells are real. Until don't sweat it. Enjoy your life. And thanks for listening. We're here every Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Hope you can join us next time. Say bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Later.
Bye. Cool.
Thank you for having me. WOZOLP 103.9 FM, Knoxville.